4.6 billion.
The Earth forms.
Cambrian.
542 million.
Complex life explodes.
Permian Triassic.
251 million.
90% of species die.
Cretaceous Tertiary.
65 million.
Meteor kills the dinosaurs.
55 million.
Primates appear.
2.3 million.
Pleistocene.
200,000.
Humans appear.
20,000.
Agricultural
250.
Revolution. Industrial Revolution.
60.
Great Acceleration.
The Anthropocene.
Welcome to Generation Anthropocene, the program where we ask the question, what does it mean to be living in the new geologic age? I'm Leslie Chang, and I'll be guest hosting this week's episode. Today's interview is with geophysicist Mark Zoback. Stay tuned.
My guest today is Professor Mark Zoback in the Department of Geophysics here at Stanford. His research incorporates the study of crustal stress and geomechanics, and his book, Reservoir Geomechanics, is now in its fifth edition. He recently served as an expert member for the Department of Energy in their investigation into shale gas reservoirs and environmental risks associated with fracking. He's also testified before the Senate on seismic risks related to carbon capture and storage. Professor Zoback, thanks for coming in today.
Oh, thank you.
So I wanted to start by asking, you've testified before Congress, you've served on Senate panels. How does that happen? How does one come to get a call from, you know, the White House or the Department of Energy to say, yeah, hey, we want to hear what you have to say about this issue?
Well, I think it's an uncertain and illogical process at times. basically, you come to work every day and you do your job. And for the past few years, I've been doing a lot of research on shale gas development, and both in terms of the optimization of the resource and minimizing the environmental impact. And that work becomes known to people. And then as these committees are staffed, your name gets mentioned and eventually you get an email or you don't.
I wonder what the reaction to that email is like. Like, I mean, is it fear? You know, I'm entering into some political realm, or is it excitement? I mean, or is it a mixture?
I think it depends. You know, the opportunity to serve on the DOE committee was exciting because it was a small committee and it was charged very specifically. The president asked the Secretary of Energy to convene a committee to look at these issues. So we knew that what we came up with had a receptive audience. The administration understands the importance of shale gas resources and also understands the fact that they can only be beneficial if we develop them while minimizing the negative environmental consequences. And so the purpose of our committee was to stand back and take a hard look at this in order to sort of lay a foundation for what can be done and what should be done to minimize the impact and to optimize the benefit.
So over these last 5 years, fracking has certainly become very political. And I think a lot of the environmental backlash was really in a response to the documentary Gasland. And my understanding is that there's a lot of misconceptions about fracking. So where do we start to kind of clear things up?
The issue of shale gas development is kind of overshadowed by these concerns about hydraulic fracturing. And I don't know of anything in my lifetime that has been so badly mischaracterized or blown out of proportion as this sort of fear of fracking that's sort of taken hold among some parts of the public. And it's become quite a cause celeb. And, you know, I've seen movie stars appear on the Daily Show and the Colbert Report, two of my favorites. Their only message wasn't to promote their latest movie, but was to rail against hydraulic fracturing, a process they didn't understand and couldn't put in an appropriate context. Now, the appropriate context is that there are definite possibilities for negative environmental impacts when shale gas is developed. Bad things can happen. Things can be spilled at the surface. You can contaminate water if you're not careful with handling things in a variety of ways. There's a wide range of things that can go wrong. And we understand these things, and they have gone wrong. And we need to do everything we can to prevent those things from happening. Hydraulic fracturing is one aspect of developing shale gas, and yet there's nothing about the hydraulic fracturing process itself that poses a danger. If a well is poorly constructed, it has the potential to leak whether you hydraulically fracture it or not. There's been no instance in which hydraulic fracturing has been shown to directly contaminate water supplies. There are contaminated water supplies. They're contaminated through the process that includes hydraulic fracturing, but it's not the hydraulic fracturing that does the contamination. So there's all this confusion between, you know, negative consequences and what actually caused those consequences. And the, you know, the point of our committee was that we have to do everything we can to minimize the negative environmental impacts, but we had to identify what those impacts were, what their causes were, and then to address those causes, you know, one by one, as opposed to these kinds of, you know, blanket bans on hydraulic fracturing, which really kind of mischaracterize the problem and don't do anything to, in fact, you know, solve the problem. These gas shale reservoirs are remarkable in that they're so widely spread. The whole story kind of began in what's called the Barnett Shale, which is in the Fort Worth Basin, the Dallas-Fort Worth area of sort of north central Texas. Since then, it's spread all around the country. And one of the major areas is what's called the Marcellus Shale in the northeast that extends from Ohio, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, and even into southern New York. And so if you were to be looking at a map, what you'd see is the potential for producing natural gas from shale in about over 26 states, I believe. And so it really is a widespread resource. And the quantity of gas, you know, that we're talking about is truly enormous. I mean, it's on the order of a 100-year supply at traditional consumption rates. And when we look at issues like, you know, how we're going to, you know, reduce greenhouse gas emissions, natural gas is something that is now working at scale and resulting in substantial reductions. And so there are many benefits to using natural gas. We know how to extract it properly. That doesn't mean we're always doing a good job, but we know how to do it, and we need to work to do it as well as to, you know, lessen the impact even more than we have in the past.
I saw in an interview that that you, like many other scientists, sort of, and many people in general, kind of characterize natural gas as a bridge fuel, as something, you know, certainly we need to be investing in renewables, solar, wind, geothermal, et cetera, but that natural gas can be a bridge fuel. Is it, when people use that term, are they really talking about it in relation to greenhouse gas emissions?
I think the term bridge fuel means different things to different people. I can tell you how I use the term. If you look out 30 or 40 years from now, I think we have every reason to be confident that we've gone a long way toward decarbonizing the energy system. You know, solar and wind keep getting cheaper and better every year. And as they become a larger and larger fraction of the energy picture, we've gone a long way toward decarbonization. And so what I mean by natural gas being a bridge is that it gets us through these next few decades. And we have very few choices. You know, we can't go to renewables overnight. You know, the scale of the energy system is just too large. But we can replace coal with natural gas, and we are doing it. And in just the past 4 years, we've seen the fraction of electricity, you know, in the United States, the fraction of electricity generated by coal-burning power plants reduced from roughly 50% to about 30%. This has resulted in a 7 or 8% decrease in CO2 emissions. That's a huge shift in 4 years simply because natural gas is cheap and abundant. And, you know, in addition to this, you know, the fact that it only generates half as much CO2, there's none of the mercury, none of the particulates, much, you know, SOx.
Nasty stuff that comes with coal.
Yeah. You know, it's, it, and This transition is occurring very quickly and has been easily accomplished, and a very large reduction in emissions has resulted from it. You know, 5 or 6 years ago, before we were really aware of the significance of this shale gas revolution, we thought we would be using coal, you know, well into the middle of the century, right, for the next 30 or 40 years. So without natural gas, the only thing we could do is wait for renewables to grow to the point of viability, you know, more than a couple percent of all the electricity that's generated, and do all we can to advance them. I mean, renewables are great, and it's ultimately, you know, they are the solution, but they're not going to be the solution for decades.
It does sound like bridge fuel is bridge to a more carbon, a less carbon-intensive economy, or less carbon-intensive energy sector. Is that more or less right?
Oh, absolutely. There has to be something on the other side of the bridge.
Right, exactly.
And natural gas still is a fossil fuel. And while it's emitting half as much CO2, it's still emitting CO2.
Right.
And, you know, we want to decarbonize. But decarbonization is a process. And switching from coal to natural gas is part of that process. It is not the solution. It's part of getting us to where we need to go.
Something I've heard you say is that the shale gas revolution is the biggest revolution since nuclear went commercial. But it got me thinking about nuclear. Even before Fukushima, what I've heard from people whose opinion I'm inclined to trust is that the risks associated with nuclear have been blown way out of proportion, that it's actually a much safer energy source than we give it credit for. But now it's just politically not viable, and that made all the more complicated by Fukushima. So I wonder if there's lessons to be learned from the commercialization of nuclear that we ought to be thinking about as we ramp up shale gas production.
Well, absolutely. I think there are a lot of lessons to be learned. And one lesson is that once you lose public support, it's awfully hard to get back. And, you know, if the public thinks that nuclear is unsafe, it almost doesn't matter what the statistics show. It's very hard to change public opinion. And I think public opinion was beginning to change, and there was a lot of discussion of a nuclear renaissance in this country. But Fukushima, of course, was a terrible disaster and has really kind of set back public opinion with respect to nuclear power. And it's going to be incumbent on the nuclear industry to, you know, recapture public opinion and convince the public that they can operate safely in order to have consent to go forward. In the shale gas business, in the early years of shale gas development, there were mostly small companies. Some of those companies, frankly, did not intend to be viable gas producers. Rather, they wanted to simply demonstrate the viability of their resource and then sell their assets to a larger company. But now that's changed quite a bit. You know, the major oil companies are all heavily involved. At the same time, the state regulatory agencies have had to sort of gear up to deal with the greatly accelerated level of activity in various parts of the country, some of which, you know, traditionally didn't have a lot of oil and gas development. And so they had to get up to speed. And that's happened very effectively in some parts of the country, maybe less effectively in others. And that's something that needs work.
Well, so I would like to talk about some of the legitimate environmental concerns around shale gas production. And my read on it, my understanding of things, is that part of the reason we're having this revolution in natural gas production is because the technology has advanced so much. We can do these horizontal drilling. We can go down and then across. And my first question is, how the hell did they do that? that kind of is mind-boggling to me, that the technology is such that you can go down and then over.
Well, I can't explain it to you on the radio. Visual props are necessary. That technology, plus hydraulically fracturing from what's called the toe of the well, the most distant part, back toward the heel of the well, the part that bends from vertical to horizontal, has been perfected. The challenge is that these rocks we're talking about, these shales, a shale is a sedimentary rock with lots of clay, and of course, in this case, it has organic material in it as well. These rocks are a million times less permeable than a traditional gas reservoir. So the real secret was not finding the gas. The industry sort of always knew it was there. The real secret was figuring out how to produce it economically, and this combination of horizontal drilling and multi-stage hydraulic fracturing is what enabled this rock with extremely low permeability. I mean, these rocks
permeability are, being a measurement of pore space and how fluids move around in the rock.
Permeability is a measure of how easy the fluids move through the rock, and these rocks are essentially impermeable. I mean, they have the lowest permeability of all rocks, found near the Earth's surface, like I said, a million times smaller than a traditional reservoir. And the hydraulic fracturing is very important in that process. The chemicals that are used in hydraulic fracturing are really quite benign.
And this is something that has received a lot of the attention.
Well,
right?
Yeah, and there's some unfortunate history to this. So the chemicals that are used accomplish a couple different things. One is a friction reducer. It's kind of like soap. You know, when you're doing the dishes, that slippery feeling is exactly the material that's being added. A biocide is added because, at temperatures less than about 100 degrees, centigrade, there are natural microbes in the water, and those can actually corrode the casing and cause damage downhole. And so you add a biocide, which is sort of no more toxic than the Clorox that we add to whiten our whites. Mm-hmm. A little bit of a viscosifier is added. It thickens the water, but not very much. It's fairly thin fracturing fluid. But the viscosifier that is used is guar. Guar is made from beans, mostly grown in India. And guar is the thickener that's used in ice cream. So we have this rather benign fluid that's used. And the guar is used, by the way, the thickener is used because you're also injecting sand. Because after you make the hydraulic fracture, when you depressurize, you don't want that hydraulic fracture to completely close and the sand stays in there to hold it open a little bit. This fluid poses no danger to the public whatsoever.
But this is the public thinks that it does, right? This
yeah.
is where some of the misconceptions are?
This is where some of the misconceptions are. Because during the Bush administration, an exemption was granted to the Safe Drinking Water Act that said that the companies who were doing the hydraulic fracturing did not have to disclose what was in the fracturing fluid. Well, this was really silly because there's nothing in the fracturing fluid that people should be afraid of, but the exemption has made them very paranoid. Now, there's another part of hydraulic fracturing that needs to be talked about, and that's what happens after hydraulic fracturing. So you make these hydraulic fractures, a given well, it varies from part of the country to part of the country, but say there are 10 hydraulic fractures made in a given well along a horizontal section that might be 5,000 feet long. After all those hydraulic fractures are made, you produce back the water that you've injected. You want to get it out of the way so that the gas can flow more.
So you easily. Push it in and then it comes back
Yeah, out. You inject it in sort of 10 stages, and then when you're all done, you sort of flow it all back at once. And this is called flow back water. When the water flows back, it's far more toxic than when you injected it because it's been interacting with the shale. And what it brings back is a lot of salt, so it's very saline. And it also can bring back various heavy metals, iron and arsenic and selenium and other things like that. So these are naturally occurring in the shale at depth, and now you've brought them to the surface in the flowback water. So the flowback water has to be disposed of or reused in an appropriate manner. So this is an important issue, the water handling of flowback water. Now, traditionally, what's been done is the water's been injected into a permitted injection well. So the EPA has guidelines for these wells, and an operator would apply for a permit. And when that permit is granted, they'd be able to inject that water back at great depth where it could not come into contact with aquifers and other sources of water used by the public. In some parts of the country, such as in the Marcellus Formation that I mentioned before in the Northeast, there turns out that there are not many good geologic formations available to inject that water. So they were hauling water from Pennsylvania to Ohio and doing all sorts of things which were expensive and difficult. And it turns out that it's actually more efficient to recycle the water. So they take the water that flows back, they put it in holding ponds, which are, you know, carefully engineered so it doesn't penetrate the ground and wildlife can't, you know, interact with the water. And then they reuse that water for drilling and hydraulic fracturing and subsequent wells. So, you know, there is no disposal problem. And that's really the best thing to do. It's another way to cut down on the amount of water that you use, because it does take millions of gallons of water to hydraulically fracture a well. In some parts of the country, that's no big deal. In other parts of the country, millions of gallons of water are in short supply. So the less water you use, you know, the better job you'll do.
I think probably most prevalent concern, especially because of gas land, is the worry that hydraulic fracturing will lead to natural gas in aquifers. You mentioned earlier, a lot of this can be dealt with by sound well construction. Where are we with that right now? I mean, is the problem with well construction a regulatory issue?
Well, you asked several things there, so let me try to, I'll try to kind of deconstruct this.
I had
things.
Too much coffee.
Yeah,
I apologize.
Yeah, the hydraulic fracturing that's been occurring in the United States has principally been at a depth of between 5 and 10,000 feet. And at this depth, it's very clear that the hydraulic fractures do not grow up and interact with the water supply. You know, there's thousands of feet of it, relatively impermeable rock separating the shale, you know, from the water supplies, and hydraulic fracturing is being done safely and has no possibility of contaminating water supplies. Now, if there's a well construction problem, the gas can leak up, you know, between the steel casing and the rock if it's not well cemented, right? It can leak up and cause contamination. And it's a well construction problem. It's not a hydraulic fracturing problem. The fact that you did hydraulic fracturing is just coincidental. Now, as long as you have that separation between these, you know, the wells that are used for water supplies, which are typically fairly shallow, a few hundred feet, maybe 1,000 feet in some unusual instances. So they're very close to the surface. And the shales, which are at 5 to 10,000 feet, as long as you have this large separation, the hydraulic fractures are nothing to worry about. But if you're doing hydraulic fracturing at a depth that's very shallow and just below the water supply, you know, that's a different story. And there, you know, well may be shales at shallow depth that simply cannot be hydraulically fractured safely. So, you know, it's just recognizing the geologic conditions and when it's safe to proceed. And the situation here in the U.S. has been, it's almost everywhere, it's been very safe to proceed. But there may be cases where it's not safe to proceed, and we have to be aware of that. The issue of well construction is a little bit complicated. The regulation of well construction is done state by state. And this is appropriate because the regulations have to match the geologic conditions. And a good example of that is Pennsylvania. What's done in eastern Pennsylvania is completely different than what's done in western Pennsylvania because the geology is different. And therefore, the casing, the construction practice of the well is different in these two places. And the people of Pennsylvania know more about this than anyone else. And a uniform federal regulation would never work. Pennsylvania is also another good example because as shale gas activity, you know, began to heat up, they hired something like, I think, about 175 new regulators, and they put them through a very intensive training process so they were up to speed and then could be out there, you know, regulating the oil and gas industry. And so this is an example of sort of how to do it right. You adapt the regulations to match the geology, you staff up as appropriate. I mean, the industry is paying for this, you know, through fees and you know, and other charges, and you regulate the industry appropriately. If that's not being done properly in a state, in a given state, however, then you potentially have a problem. So our DOE committee recommended a group called Stronger, which is the State Review of Oil and Natural Gas Environmental Regulations, and it's a group in which, you know, people from one state help people in another state with their environmental regulations. And so the states that have more experience, more expertise, who are doing it right, can advise those who might be just, you know, kind of new to the game or, you know, needing to upgrade their regulations or staff up appropriately to do it. So it's, you know, it's an uneven picture if you look nationally, but I think the states having jurisdiction is appropriate. But you could look to some, you know, uniform standards, for example, what you're trying to accomplish in well construction, what you're trying to accomplish in water handling, what you're trying to accomplish in air pollution, in traffic mitigation, and all these other ways in which you want to lessen the impact of shale gas development, you could have federal guidelines, okay, and then still have state regulation and enforcement.
What other misconceptions are there that need to be cleared up about fracking?
The problem isn't fracking, and it's really frustrating for the environmental impact of shale gas development always to be characterized as fracking. And, you know, it's one thing for a movie star who's emotionally engaged but perhaps not knowledgeable of what's going on. But when it comes to taking, you know, responsible action and building appropriate regulations and for states to adapt appropriate policies, you know, they have to look at the problem comprehensively and appropriately. And so, but it's a constant battle to move even the question away from how do we do shale, you know, move it to how do we do shale gas development right, instead of what are we going to do about hydraulic fracturing?
Right. Well, Professor Zoback, this has been a real pleasure. It was extremely informative, and thanks so much for coming in.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Generation Anthropocene. We want to thank Pam Mattson and Stanford School of Earth Sciences for their support. As always, a big thanks to Tom Hayden for guidance and inspiration. Thanks to Maserati for use of their song Monoliths, and thanks to KZSU Stanford 90.1. You can find all of our past episodes at stanford.edu/group/Anthropocene, and you can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @GenAnthropocene. History is accelerating, and you're a part of it too. Where would you draw the line?